Okay, DS106, we're on the air. This is... Okay, we are on the radio. You're being recorded. This is our...
Nobody's saying anything incriminating.
No one's saying anything about Guy. We're going to talk. This is the part two of our discussion of Strangers on a Train. And we got into some really interesting territory last night, or last time we discussed. In part thanks to Leo, and, you know, I want to hope you have chalk here. I don't think, do I see any chalk? I love that we have old school chalkboard. Someone want to run down the hall and see if they can find any chalk?
Yeah, thank you.
See if you find chalk in another room, and then bring it here. Steal it liberally.
Okay, I will do that.
Okay, so last time we finished up our discussion talking about Dostoevsky, talking about the question of morality, this question of guilt. And one of the interesting things I started thinking about, not only about the discussion you brought up, Leo, which is about how the second half of Strangers on the Train plays out. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
So we talked about Dostoevsky, and what particular book did we talk about, Leo?
Crime and Punishment.
I always spell that. D-O-S-T-O-E? Where's that?
There's a V.
After E.
Just want to be sure. I know there's another Russian spelling. I'm not going to even try and do
if
that.
If you want, I can find another.
You want to do it in Russian?
That will be fine. You can see.
Leo, show us the Russian characters for Dostoevsky.
Characters.
You're a character. We want to see the characters.
Is that Egyptian?
That's great.
Inside.
So this is how we spell it, and this is how it really looks, right? Can you solve this mystery? This is kind of wild. So that's Dostoevsky in Russia. And so we talked about Dostoevsky. In particular, we talked about Crime and Punishment. Which actually, if I were to teach this class again, and you guys would stop having so much fun, I actually might bring Crime and Punishment in as a very early text and think about a lot of the questions and the morality we're talking about right now in relationship to that. Because Leo brought up a couple of good points. Not only the question about the idea of him being a Uberman or some sort of Superman, right? Which we hear again about in Strangers on a Train. So there's that. But it's also, Dostoevsky was very influential, his literature, in the thinking of Nietzsche. So Nietzsche actually referred back to Dostoevsky several times in his writing as one of the kind of most important thinkers of the 19th century. For him devising his philosophy of what is now known amongst him and other people of existentialism. So again, we come back to this idea of existentialism. Now, let's talk about this idea of the Superman, or what is called the Übermensch. You like the way I say Übermensch?
Yeah, that is good, my point.
Thank you, very good. Your Russian is as good as your German.
Yeah, ich spreche keine Deutsch, mein Freund.
Okay.
I like his. Ich habe keine Ahnung. I probably said shit. Ish. But let's think about this idea of Superman for a second. Superman is a concept that Nietzsche kind of plays out, and it's a concept where Nietzsche's philosophy in some ways gets torn by the Nazi Party, where they start thinking of this kind of an Übermensch or an Uber race. We had the whole kind of horror of the 30s and 40s and that vision of Nazi Germany. But we actually see in several major texts in the early 20th century this idea come up again and again. And it's interesting, I hadn't thought about it before until I was reading the book for the second time. Has anyone ever heard of a movie called Rope? R-O-P-E? Okay, it was also, like Strangers on a Train, the film, it was directed by Hitchcock, and it's a very interesting narrative and has a very interesting relationship to Strangers on a Train. A couple of reasons. technically, it's an amazing film because it was shot in two shots. The entire film. Have you heard about it? Like, it's two shots. The whole film.
I have heard of that.
Okay, good. The other thing is, it focuses around these two characters. James Stewart is in the film, as is, I don't know who the other two actors are, but they're based on real historical figures. It was Leopold and another character whose name I'm forgetting. And actually, they were, at the time, in the early 20th century, gay lovers. And they imagined themselves as supermen based on Nietzsche's philosophy, and they went about to create the perfect murder. So it's interesting that Hitchcock should take Rope, which is kind of a very interesting movie in many levels, which has a lot of the kind of concepts at the heart of at least the novel of Strangers on a Train. Now, Strangers on a Train, the film, is very different. In the film, Guy doesn't kill the father. In the film, there's no Gerard. There's no detective. There's no Bruno falling off the boat. None of that. There's no him returning to Owen and telling his whole story. Actually, the film, you never really have this idea of a bad guy. You know, Haynes is not a bad guy. Guy is not a bad guy. Bruno is a maniac through and through, but has a very different vision. But there's this kind of moment in, I think, there's not only the question of class that we talked about last time, but there's also this re-emergence of a lot of the concepts we've seen in many of the novels we've read so far. This kind of Nietzschean question of morality, which was a great link back to Dostoevsky and Crime and Punishment, and this is making me think about a revision of this class. But also the re-emergence of this vision of existentialism, right? And kind of, even though we're in a new moment, we're in the 50s, and we're going to talk a bit about what it means to be in the 50s tonight based on this book. It's also, we have a very similar philosophical thread driving almost everything we've read so far, right? And it's this thread, and it makes sense if these are detective stories or stories about murder, even though we could argue As the Dusk isn't. As the Dusk might be the most, in some ways, forward example of dealing with existentialism, even though it doesn't deal with murder. Every one of them has this question of morality. And what it kind of, for me, underlines is what a force, philosophically, Nietzsche is as a thinker for the 20th century, for framing out the ideas. And there are many important thinkers, right? And when I was in college, one of the things that I always thought was useful is there's three major schools of thought that drive 20th century thought. FMN. Who's
Freud.
Freud. Thank you. Very good, Leo. Big fan of yours tonight. Who's this?
Malcolm X.
No. Jesse? No. No, no,
Jesse,
no. We're talking at the beginning of the 19th to the 20th century. Who are the major three thinkers?
Nietzsche.
Nietzsche, yeah, we got him here, so we'll get Nietzsche. Who else? Who's the middle one? And we've kind of talked around his ideas. Mendel, no.
Mencken.
H.L. Mencken. H.L. Mencken, no. But Mencken actually fits in with the Nietzsche kind of threat. He's also very much a German. I don't want to look, I'm not trying to say, hey, it starts with an M, it's four letters. Want to play Hangman?
Yes.
Thomas Mann.
Thomas Mann, no. Freund. No, Freund.
No, it's the second one.
Is there an
Don't write it out.
No.
Marx.
Marx.
No.
Oh,
oh,
no.
Did
you say Marx or after Malcolm X?
Oh, my God.
The first
and
last
letter
is
Marx.
Freud, Marx, and Nietzsche.
And then Engels.
Why would these three be kind of the pillars of what would be critical philosophical thought over the 20th and even into the 21st century? I mean, these two thinkers still, in very many ways, inform the way our culture understands itself. Freud, because? psychoanalysis, right? Sex.
Yes,
sex.
All these
sex.
Theories born because of sex, right? Oh, why Freud? He was really good at
sex.
Sex. No, he was a thinker. He was a psychoanalyst, right? He kind of framed the whole way of trying to understand the human mind. And psychoanalysis is not only kind of a practice, but it's also a whole frame of critical discourse that, you know, kind of spans the humanities. What about Marx?
Communism.
Communism, sure. I mean, he was a commie. What else? What did he theorize?
Oh, so talking about the builders.
Socialism. The workers. Labor. The whole question of labor, socialism, communism. But he was a theorist about labor and work and the value of work in the 20th century in relationship to capitalism. So in many ways, he was both a sociologist and an economist.
We talked about this in sociology.
It all connects. That's the liberal education vision. It's all connected. Right? And what's this?
No,
Nazi. No, Nietzsche is not Nazi. If that's what you get out of this class, I failed you. Nietzsche has everything to do with rethinking the philosophical paradigm that's come before. Rethinking the kind of traditional ways in which we understand. Right?
Religion.
Who we are. Religion, the idea of Christianity, the tradition of Greek thought. Right? Nietzsche is one of the great philosophers who asked us at the very core to rethink and deconstruct the traditions we have kind of inherited. Right? Nietzsche is probably one of the most important thinkers of the 19th, 20th century for kind of ushering in a moment of rethinking so many of our assumptions as a culture, at least in the Western world. So, philosophy, sociology, and economics, and Freud would be for psychology and a whole field in many ways. These are three pillars of 20th century thought. Now, one of the things that's interesting is I like this kind of thinking because Highsmith, and we can argue every writer up and until Highsmith we've read, brings these three together in some really powerful ways. We'll look at some of the moments wherein which Nietzsche's theories inform it. Talked about the Superman. Talked about this idea of morality. Where do you think the question of Freud and psychoanalysis and sex might come up in Strangers on a Train? Brent?
Maybe like the Oedipus complex with Bruno and his mom, which really grosses me out. But...
I mean, think about that. That's a brilliant vision. I didn't even think about that.
Really?
That's
probably
what I was thinking of, actually,
because
from the
very
beginning,
he was
like, we're
so close. I'm closer to my mom than she is to my dad.
And then he's like
putting
all his
putting down his dad.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he wants his dad dead.
And
yeah.
How close he is to his mother?
Yeah.
And how much? Brilliant.
Yeah.
Yes,
Julie. Oh, well, I was just going to say, another way it could be how he's so obsessed with Guy, like it could be a sexual.
Well, you know, and that's another theory that kind of obviously would be built on all of these three tenets. You know, one of the big theories of the late 20th, early 21st century is this idea of queer theory, right? And queer theory has everything to do with thinking about texts that we traditionally understand as heterosexual as very much informed by homosexual relations. And it actually kind of rethinks a whole tradition and a culture that, you know, what we've tried to submerge and bury is in many ways embedded within our very culture.
We talked about that in my English class.
Look at this.
Great.
It's all related. Did I say that? Okay.
Only the
I won't. Don't anyone do that again. Because I'm going to have to do it's the all related. So it's interesting, and I want you to think about this for a second, because as we move from the readings, and our readings were kind of discussing and thinking about it, but one of the ways in which we start approaching literature is we start approaching it from a viewpoint. Like, when I start focusing on the violence of the wealthy, Bruno's leisure, and how Guy talks about that when you give the rich people too much freedom, they may just turn murder into a kind of hobby, right? I mean, there's this whole kind of deep reading about labor, capitalism, wealth, right? And that would be, for many people, called a Marxist reading. If I go the way that Brenna went quite brilliantly, and talked about Bruno and the Oedipus complex, and maybe framed that around the questions of sexuality, some people might call that a Freudian or some sort of psychoanalyst, right? I'm not psychoanalyst, really. I don't know why I'm saying it wrong. It's like, we'll call it Freudian for now. It's not psychological, no. It's psychoanalytical, I think. I'm missing it, but I'll come back to it. And for example, if you wanted to focus on the question of morality or the lack thereof in Superman, you might make that a Nietzschean reading, right? Or start deconstructing some of those values. And more recent theory, you might read Bruno and Guy's relationship in relationship to queer theory. And what does that say about this moment? Now, that's kind of just a side note, because I think the stuff that Leo brought up last time kind of starts to open up the fact that literature is not just, hey, this was a really interesting book. Great. It is that. But it's also, when it's great, I think, is it invested in a whole tradition of thinking at a particular moment in time. And literature, at its best, is in conversation with a tradition of thought. And these are part of the traditions of thought that you, hopefully, over the next 4 years, will start to understand. Right? How so many of our ideas, so many of our biases, so many of our prejudices, so many of the ideas we have and assume are based in many ways in these kind of pillars of Western traditional thought, at least for the last 110 years. Now, you may have thoughts and hopefully you account for things outside of the Western tradition, but this is part of what informs who we are, right? And so it's very interesting when you said that, Leo, to start kind of thinking about, well, how does the literature we're talking about right now, not just this is an interesting book about murder, but this is an interesting book about Freudian thought, labor, and also morality, if not questions of sexuality and queer theory. Right? It becomes bigger. And what this also might help you start doing, I want to take a moment to talk about this too, is thinking about, so what if you were to write a paper on one of these books? Mm-hmm. What if you were to start thinking critically about one of these books? One of these theoretical approaches might help you, like Brenda suggested, frame an argument. You know, a Freudian reading of Strangers on a Train might start with Bruno's relationship to his father, or Guy's relationship to his wife, right? So, interesting. Kind of just plant that as a seed. All right, so let's jump out of that kind of more generalized thinking and step back into the novel a little bit more specifically. Because one of the things you have to balance as you start reading both more abstractly for philosophical concepts, you have to be good, to be accurate, to have some kind of rich reading. You have to anchor that stuff in the text. That's why we spend so much time reading the text closely. That's why I spend so much time ripping apart my text with a pen. Because the text is your evidence. If we're detectives trying to come up with a theory like Girard, it's the text that brings our argument together. Without the text, we have nothing. The text is where I'm going to convince you of something or not. If I can't refer back to that text, well, then I don't really have an argument. If I can't make that text have meaning above and beyond what you read on the page, then I haven't really done my job. So that's kind of part of how these larger philosophical approaches, in my mind, in literary thinking, starts to meet the text. And through the two, you start to build an argument. Right? It's kind of a, you know, it's funny because it took me a long time, almost up and through grad school, to kind of understand this. You know, and it's not, I'm saying you have to all understand it right now, but kind of interesting, like, why do we read literature? Why are you here reading 10 or 11 books this semester? I hope so that you start grappling with some of the bigger, conceptual, philosophical pillars of Western thought. If you're not doing that, you're wasting your time. I think. Right? Sarah? You with me? You feel it? How much? That much? That much? No, more seriously. let's talk a little bit about the text. We stopped at a page 90?
Look at this.
What's that?
I didn't know father.
We have father 90. Okay. Yeah, this. Money. Which is, did anyone, page 104, let's stop there for a second. Did anyone read Paul Bond's post? I must reference Paul Bond at least once a class.
At least three times.
Yeah, maybe, but he blogs. You guys remember that thing, the little thing called the blog?
What does he,
yes,
what does he do for the media?
What
does
he do?
He
reads great literature,
okay,
he's a librarian,
okay,
and he blogs for Hard Boiled.
Why?
Let's all say hi to Paul, ready? Because he's listening probably. Ready? On three, we're going to say hi, Paul. And you guys can say stop blogging so much if you want. But I like that he makes you feel good. On three. One, two, three.
Hi,
hi Paul.
Where does he live? Like,
I think he lives in either upstate, he's in Pennsylvania or upstate. He's not a creepy guy. He's asking what he's. Oh, she's creepy.
It's like,
he's
a guy in Paul.
He's in the internet watching your every move.
That's what I'm thinking.
He's a great man.
He's in the internet. He's a great man. That's right. I like that. Paul Bond's a great man. The one person I forgot to put in these three pillars is Paul Bond. There's Freud, there's Marx, there's Nietzsche, and there's Bond. Not James Bond.
What's
that?
Is that what that
says? No, that does not say Bond. Unbelievable. I'm way too loose right now in the class. You need to get serious. This is higher ed. Where we make the connection. Anyway. Let's calm down. And what?
And talk about pimples.
Talk about pimples. Pimples are a
boil,
right? Yeah, the pimple.
Unboiled
pimple. I don't know if you, I haven't.
Boiled pimple.
Hard boiled pimples. All right, you guys are going to make it hard. And I see all of you like, how long can we distract them? Like,
yeah,
it's a half an hour already. Just me and record people. We need to be serious. Okay.
Yeah, guys, Paul Bond is listening right now.
That's right.
Paul Bond.
Paul Bond.
Paul Bond isn't listening. He's actually blogging. And he's blogging this class now.
He's
live
blogging.
He's live blogging.
Vlog.
Our class motto should be make Paul proud.
Oh, I don't know if you heard that, but someone said our motto should be make Paul proud. It's very alliterative.
Paul Bond president.
Hey, wait, all right. Let's go back. As I was saying about poor Paul Bond before you guys
attacked.
We voted him for president. He's officially now president.
Is he? You're gonna write him in? Okay. This is big. If you can go from hard boiled to president, think about what that means for all of you. Okay. 104. Paul Bond, have you heard of him? He actually wrote on his blog. Let me go to the space here. Where is it? Oh, here. On 104, first full paragraph. Elsie stood up and slid her thumb inside her belt. The bulge just below her belt disappeared, and for a moment she looked Bruno. Had seen her all her life until this last year. Trim as a 20-year-old, down to her thin ankles. Your guy's friend got a nice face. Nicest fellow you ever saw. It's a shame he dragged it on. He told me on the train he hadn't seen his wife in a couple of years. Guy's no more a murderer than I am. Bruno smiled at the inadvertent joke and covered to add it. His wife was around heels anyway. Now, anyone go and look up what round heels meant? We talked about it.
We talked about it.
We talked it, right? It means, I think Jesse said, ho, or whore.
Yeah.
Terrible word. But actually, Paul Bond went beyond Jesse, as he's known to do. And he actually looked up. You better, he's blogging.
No,
I'm like you.
Like
the round heels, do you know what that means? Why they say round heels, why that would be, why would round heels mean, you know, loose,
you know,
moral? I know, because I read Paul's blog. Do you?
Because they have hard heels because they're always walking the streets.
No.
I'm making this up.
Yeah.
Well, share your knowledge with
us.
It's because with the round heels, you can more easily slip back into missionary position.
Stop.
That's seriously what it means.
In what way is that?
The shape of the heel effect.
Yes! You can step back in! But let's stop for a second. Even that, isn't that far more elegant than Ho? Like, Ho is just a Ho. Round heel is some elegant movement back into missionary. And it's even missionary.
No, that's why imagery that we didn't need.
It's a, look.
Yeah, none of us.
I didn't invent their English language. I'm just bringing it to you. All right. So anyway, round heels. Put that back in your Rolodex. Okay. Now, let's move on. Brotherhood. There's a couple of things I want to talk about. Let me go to Bruno. Talks about him as a friend. I want to, there's a couple of points I want to make, but one of them is, let's talk about Bruno and Guy's relationship. Page 114 and 115. And this is after Bruno has killed Guy's wife. This is when Guy still hasn't killed Bruno's father. And that's a big difference between the book and the movie, I said. Guy never killed Bruno's father in the movie. And we're starting to understand what's going on between Bruno and Guy. And let's start at the bottom of page 114. Hello, Bruno said, and move and read up through 115. Does anyone want to read that? Hello, Bruno said. Yes. Thank you, Sharon.
Hello, Bruno said.
Loud.
Paul needs to hear you.
Paul needs to hear you is right.
Hello, Bruno said, his voice soft and melancholy. His face was barely visible in the dusk. Hello, Guy replied, as if to a stranger, and walked on. Guy and Anne turned at the same time. Bruno came toward them, hands in the pockets of his overcoat. What is it? Guy asked. Just wanted to say hello. Ask how you are. Bruno stared at Anne with a kind of perplexed, smiling resentment. I'm fine, Guy said quietly. He turned away, drawing Anne with him. Who is he? Anne whispered. Guy itched to look back. He knew Bruno would be standing where they had left him, knew he would be looking after them, weeping perhaps. He's a fellow who came around looking for work last week. You can't do anything for him? No, he's an alcoholic.
Okay, good. You can stop there. So, what do you make of this? This is one of the first, and it starts getting more and more as the book goes on. What do you make of this? Any points about it? Mike?
Guy's trying to go back on his deal. It starts right there.
And let's stop for a second, because that's important. Guy's going back on his deal. What deal did Guy make with Bruno?
No deal. That's what
he never made a deal, but that's important that you think that. Because more and more, who starts to get brought into that mindset too?
Guy.
He never made a deal. He never asked Bruno to kill his wife. At the same time, like you're suggesting, he feels guilty. He's become complicit. Why?
Because he knew Bruno was crazy, and he
suggested
this, and he should have said something.
Accomplice, afraid. Who else is he afraid of?
Anne.
There's this real kind of weird relationship with not only losing Anne, but that whole question of wealth and money and Anne.
And acceptance, I think.
Acceptance. Now, Paul Bond also on his blog, I just want to see how you would react, had a great book cover for Strangers on the Train from the 50s. It was one of those great old book covers. And one of the things they said is, basically, I'm paraphrasing, a kind of relationship between a madman and a weak man. Now, how many of you agree with that assessment about Guy? Is Guy weak? You say yes, Sarah. Why?
Just because he never seems to like even if he wants to do something, or if he thinks that he should do something, he never actually like goes through with it. Like with his architecture plan, he knows what he needs to do, and he knows how he can do it, but he never seems to have, like, the motivation or the, like, almost the stamina to actually go and do things.
Yeah. And, you know, we've seen, it's funny, he gets stuck in this, right? Have we seen any other man like that before? In any of the books? Anyone you could think of?
Bandini,
yeah. He's just, but
he's
an arm all
the
time.
Yeah.
Man. Who else? We liked him, but he was absolutely ineffectual for helping her.
Right.
Burr, right? And think about relationship of Mildred, and then think about Anne. What do we know about Anne?
She's
powerful. What does she do?
She's
a fashion designer. And she's probably one of the best in her field, as is actually Guy and his, as we learned throughout the book. But Anne's an interesting character. And when we were watching the movie last night, my wife was like, you know, the women in this movie, they're all so weak. It's only like the two men in their relationship. But it's interesting how in the book, that might be true too, and you could argue that, but in the book, Anne is the most together. She makes more money than Guy. She has, in many ways, just as much respect. Right? Kind of, in many ways, Mildred, or like Mildred. But another interesting moment that we haven't really kind of come to terms with is we're in the 1950s. And unlike the period we spent in the Depression, what do we know about everyone in this moment?
It's like set familial relationships,
yeah.
Like women stay at home.
They're not, like, you know, Anne, she is working, so she's kind of an exception, but there's a point in the book, and we'll look at it, where it says she could have been one of those women who just took a career for a year or two to say she did it, and then stayed at home. She was the exception, right? She was unlike, like, she's kind of like Mildred. But in many ways, the idea was you took a career cursorily, and then you stayed home and became the vision of the kind of homemaker. Which is an idea that came up again and again when we're talking about Mildred Pierce. Many of you like Mildred Pierce, she's the first Rosie the Riveter, right? You wrote about that, Michael, like she's strong. And we had this moment in the 40s when all the men were at World War II, that women were not only playing, were not only the kind of breadwinners, they were working in the factories, they were building planes, cars, etc. They were also the baseball entertainment, right? They were kicking ass at home. They proved that so many ideas that so many ideas about gender that we had kind of come to assume in the 30s and 40s were in many ways framed by the culture that moment. Now, one of the things that people say, and this happens in The Feminine Mystique by Betty Friedan, is she argues that what happened in the 50s, and I mentioned this in a couple of comments, is that kind of moment of the 40s of possibility that many of you linked to Mildred Pierce closed down in the 50s. Men came back to work, they got all the jobs, and the women, because of the economy, it exploded. There was all sorts of possibilities. I mean, there's a lot of wealth in this book, right? Everybody's wealthy. Everybody's got a lot of money. And when that happened, the whole question of women's rights in the workplace and their position kind of got buried. That's a whole kind of theory of another pillar of thought here we could put in, feminist theory, right? What happened from the 50s to the 2000s? What is that history of women's rights over that period of time? And the 50s is a very interesting moment for it, particularly as we're going from Mildred Pierce to Strangers on a Train. Kind of fascinating. So what else do we know about this point? So we got a lot of wealth. We got Anne, who's interesting. She's working. She even has another friend who's a commercial artist. Do you remember that friend? She's the one snooping around the room.
Holly or something.
Yeah, Holly. Yeah, that's right. I'm very interested by that because in the 50s, you also had this commercial art explosion. Do you know what great American artist started as a commercial artist?
Andy Warhol.
So this is kind of the moment where you have commercial artists that in the 60s start to become, redefine the kind of postmodern American culture. So this is very much, this book for me, feels very much embedded within the start of the 50s and a kind of new moment in American culture. Post-war, everyone gets cars. Everyone's buying new houses, the suburbs explode, right? It's the American dream. Leo's phone is going off. Everyone's excited. Turn the thing off.
I'm
talking
kidding.
About great
I
literature.
It times. It's
well, it failed both times. Okay,
good. Big fan. Now turn it on. It's a Russian phone. It doesn't work. Okay.
Let me just Chinese like all the time.
We shouldn't go there, should we?
Okay, so let's start talking a little about the 50s. What else do we know about the 50s?
Babies.
Baby boom, right? This is when the family start going. Anything strike you about this book? This book strikes me when I was reading it in a couple of ways, but there's one thing that struck me about it that I don't think I've ever read a book with so much drinking going on, right?
Great Gatsby.
Maybe the Gatsby, but I would say this outdoes the Gatsby. Like, you have Bruno having DTs, blackouts, he's at a party, he's falling over the couch, crashing out. I mean, Bruno is a full-blown drunk, as Guy is starting to become as the book moves on. But the level of alcohol consumption in this book, I would say arguably, I would put this pound for pound of The Great Gatsby, like, who's drinking more? And I think you might find that, I mean, just to talk about scotch and mint juleps, and everybody's drinking anything they do. Oh, I'm going to go out in the yard and rake the leaves. Here's a mint julep. And everyone's always getting drunk. The family's helping them get drunk. They're drinking brandy. Remember the point where a guy almost runs over a kid? This weird moment where you don't know if he actually was trying to run over the kid? And his fiance was like, hey, have some brandy. But you just ran over someone. Let's have some brandy.
Jess, yeah, Bruno's mother at one point was like, you're acting weird. Have a drink.
When they were in the bar, he thought he saw Gerard. He's like, you're acting crazy. Have another drink. And I just think, like, in some ways, the whole book for me is embedded in this dreamlike drunken state. Like, everyone you always feel is inebriated. And I think it heightens the experience of the book a little bit. You know? I don't know what it would be like. I wonder what it would be like to read this book drunk.
We should do that.
No, I don't want to do that. I don't recommend
the movie drunk.
Okay. So, point about their relationship. Let's move on. Okay. Girl. I want to get to a couple of points. Let's go 124. Move on. There's a point in time, and we just talked about it, so it's worth kind of pursuing. There's a point in time when Bruno kind of turns on Guy, right? As you noticed, he felt guilty, he didn't keep up his part of the deal. As we noted, there was no real deal, right? But there's a point at which there is a deal, right? And Bruno starts writing Guy letter after letter after letter. And he becomes that annoying thing, right? He's there, like, at every point. Remember the point he's in the woods? He's walking into the house and there's this black spot in the woods and Guy comes back out and they're fighting in the woods because he's kind of creeping around the woods at the parents' house. Really creepy. 124, he's a true creeper. So let's go, full paragraph, first full paragraph on 124. Let's go down to about, the letters were sometimes drunken, like everything in this book. I mean, who wants to start reading it? The letters were sometimes drunken. And you can read it with a slip. Yes, correct.
The letters were sometimes drunken. It showed in the type of mistakes and in the emotional bursts of the last paragraphs. If he were sober, the last paragraph was affectionate and reassuring as to the ease of the murder. If he were drunk, the paragraph was either a gush of brotherly love or a threat to haunt Guy all his life, ruin his career and his love affair, and a reminder that Bruno had the upper hand. All the necessary information might have been gotten from any one of the letters, as if Bruno anticipated he might tear most of them up unopened. But despite his determination to tear up the next, Guy would open it when it came, curious as to the variations in the last paragraph. But Bruno's three plans, the one with the gun, using the back entrance of the house, came up most often, though each letter invited him to take his choice.
Okay, keep on reading.
The letters affected him in a perverse way. After the shock of the first, the next few bothered him hardly at all. Then as the 10th, 12th, 15th appeared in his mailbox, he felt they hammered at his consciousness on his nerves in a manner that he could not analyze.
Good. First of all, what do you make a Guy in this?
Frustrating.
Right. Why? Why is Guy frustrating?
Because he's a good guy, but he's letting himself be so negatively affected by his person, and it's just, like, it's corrupting him. It was just really frustrating for me.
So what is in it for Guy to be drawn into this?
Nothing.
So then why is it?
He's weak.
Well, it's kind
he's
of like
weak.
Blackmail.
Blackmail?
He's guilty.
It's a guilty conscience, though at this point he still hasn't killed anyone. But there's also this question, again, that comes up of brotherly love, of this perverse attraction, right? In almost every passage where you're dealing with the two, there's something about Guy himself that seems drawn, and more as the book goes on, to Bruno, right? I mean, there's a connection there that we kind of at this point can't start. You know, for example, let's look at that. The paragraph with either a gush of brotherly love or a threat to haunt Guy all his life, ruin his career and his love affair, in quotes, and a reminder that Bruno had the upper hand. And then skipping down a couple of lines, Guy would open it when it came, curious as to the variations in the last paragraph. What do you make of He just described the last paragraph as what? And why is he reading these letters?
He's curious. It's like a sick interest. He can't help it.
Huh. A perverse interest in what Bruno will do next. Mm-hmm. And there starts to be... I mean, I like how Patricia Highsmith doesn't beat you over the head with it. But Guy, in many ways, is an accomplice. He's letting Bruno go. I mean, he could have, like... You ever seen Woody Woodpecker? Does that matter to any of you? Kind of. Remember, there was this great classic Woody Woodpecker episode. If Woody would have gone right to the police, none of this would have ever happened. And that's how I feel about Guy. If Guy would have went right to the police, none of this would have ever happened. But he didn't. And in many ways, he's kind of bringing it in and bringing Bruno to him. So at the end of the book, Bruno is talking about Guy as his, him and Guy as Superman. You know, as actually this kind of relationship. Not unlike that's between the two characters in Rope. Kind of an interesting thing. We talk about Guy's... Let's go to 126. This is Bruno sending Guy all these letters, kind of really talking to Guy about basically preparing to kill his father, right? And on 126, there's that whole letter Bruno sends to Guy. Anyone want to read that letter? Sure.
Samuel Bruno, Bruno seldom referred to him as my father, is the finest example of the worst that America produces. He comes of low-class peasants in Hungary, little better than animals. He picked a wife of good family with his usual greed once he could afford her. All this time, my mother quietly bore his unfaithfulness, having some concept of the sacredness of marriage contract. Now in his old age, he tries to act pious before it is too late, but it is too late. I wish I could kill him myself, but I have explained to you, due to Gerard, his private detective, it is impossible. If you ever had anything to do with him, he would be your personal enemy too. He is the kind of man who thinks all your ideas about architecture as beauty and about adequate houses for everyone are idiotic, doesn't care what kind of factory he has, as long as the roof doesn't leak and ruin his machinery. It may interest you to know his employees are on strike now. See New York Times last Thursday, page 31, bottom left. They are striking for a living wage. Samuel Bruno does not hesitate to rob his own son.
Good. I love this kind of letter in which Bruno frames out who his father is for Guy, so Guy feels more comfortable killing him, right? Kind of the idea. So, what do you make of this letter? Anything, I mean, I read this letter in a kind of different ways. Jess?
I just thought it was interesting how he brought in architecture into
yeah.
it, and like, kind of like trying to play towards like, Guy's one thing that he always talks about is like, not tainted, and he like gets away from like doing his work, and then Bruno brings in this architecture, like, to get him thinking about, oh, he just wants a roof over his head, like nothing elaborate, like you could design. Like
yeah.
trying to play towards him.
He's playing towards this thing. And then it's also this one thing. He's like, my father, he was a Hungarian immigrant of low-class peasantry, kind of like how he looked at Miriam and Miriam's family and the houses. And yet on the other end of the letter, what is he arguing for? You know?
Against the rich.
Against the rich, exactly. He's like, you know, these people aren't even, he's the person who's not even paying a living wage. So there's kind of hypocrisy even within the passage. He's from low stocks. I mean, he's the American dream, his father. Came here with nothing as an immigrant, built himself up to a tycoon. And it's interesting how he ends the passage with the New York Times article, his workers are on strike for a livable wage. And at some point, I have it here in the side note, it's like, when did Bruno become a champion for the poor? Right? It's just this weird, like you're saying, just this kind of argument to kind of get Guy to murder his dad. Using almost, even in the same moment, he's being hypocritical, right? Because he's no lover of the poor, right? He hates their sense. He looks down at them. So, interesting point with that. Now, there's the, on 128 and 129 is when we find him in the woods, waiting and watching Guy and Anne. Let's keep on going, though. There's a point where Bruno comes to Guy. Let's go to 146. Jump over. And that's that first, it's not a full paragraph, it's the first partial paragraph at the top. Who wants to start reading? Guy examined him from the second passage. Who wants to start reading? Yeah. Connor, go.
Guy examined him from his small brown shoes to his stringly oiled hair. As if from his physical appearance he could discover what had caused his change of feeling, or even what the feeling was. It was familiarity and something more, something brotherly. Bruno clicked the gun shut and turned to him. His face was heavier than the last time Guy had seen it, flushed and more alive than he remembered ever having seen it. His gray eyes looked bigger with his tears and rather golden. He looked at Guy as if he tried to find words, or as if he pled with Guy to find them. Then he moistened the thin part of the lips, shook his head, and reached an arm out toward the lamp. The light went out. When he was gone, it hardly seemed he was gone. There were just the two of them in the room, still and seated.
What do you make of this passage?
He wasn't as scared as he should be.
No, he wasn't as scared of Bruno at all, right? What was his... When we start to see this transformation in Guy over the book, what's happened? I don't know if he's falling in love with him or not, but he's certainly not scared of him anymore, and he's absolutely empathetic towards him, right? I mean, there's a point here. It was a familiarity and something more, something brotherly. There's always this something brotherly. Now, you look at how many times, and you can do this now with a search engine on Google Books, how many times the term brotherly comes up in this book? And in every context of it is trying to suggest this and you gotta realize this book was written in 1950. This kind of unspoken question of their relationship. And part of the tension maybe between them might be an unspoken form of brotherly love that wasn't talked about, right? That wasn't examined. That wasn't even kind of acknowledged. So there's this kind of interesting subtext going on throughout the book that, you know, you can't ignore. And there are points when, you know, we could say Bruno's just a maniac and Guy's this poor, weak character. But Guy is very much part of the relationship with Bruno. He engages it. You know, he's of it. You can't ignore it. I mean, it's not just Bruno now who's the man. I'm not saying Guy is either, but kind of interesting. I want to get to a point where Guy kind of talks. Let's go to this. There's a point, a couple on 148, but then I want to go to a bigger philosophical point, which will get us back to some of these questions with Dostoevsky and all that. We'll spend the last 20 minutes talking about that. But let's go to 148 for a second. Looked inquisitive, willing, strong. Let me go back. He stared at the black Luger. I'm on 147 going to 48. Which more than before struck him as outrageously large. Idiotic of someone to have made a gun so big. He got his own little revolver from the top drawer. Its pearl handle gleamed with a discreet beauty. Its short, slender barrel looked inquisitive, willing, strong, with a reserved and gallant strength. Still, he mustn't forget he'd been going to leave the Luger in the bedroom, because it was Bruno's gun. But it didn't seem worth it now to carry the heavy gun just for that. He really felt no enmity towards Bruno now. And that was the odd thing. Right? It's kind of figure of the gun. There's a great film, anyone ever see it? A Western called The Red River. John Wayne, Cliff Montgomery. There's this great scene in which these two gunfighters are comparing their guns. And they're grabbing one another's guns. And it's very homoerotic. And when you're talking about queer theory, you're talking about rereading Hollywood for these moments that obviously the writers are setting up for you, clear as day. A homoerotic situation. And you're just not acknowledging, right? It's almost, you're not seeing it because you refuse to. And this point of the heavy and the small gun and him caressing them and the beauty of the pearl and no more enmity. She's doing something here. Patricia Highsmith is doing. This is not just about the gun, right? This is about a relationship. It's the unspoken relationship of this book, right? Almost to the end. And, you know, how many of you heard The Talented Mr. Ripley?
That's such a good movie.
Also based on Patricia Highsmith. And also based upon this kind of latent, homoerotic kind of tension happening throughout the book. And it's real. And you kind of can't read this book without starting to acknowledge that. Now, let's go down a little bit. One more on paragraph of 148, and then we'll go to Guy's theory, which I think is one of the more important kind of pieces in the book. I'm starting with, there was a moment on a train. I'm going down to midway in that paragraph on 148. It's not really a gun in my pocket. I've never thought of it as a gun. I didn't buy it because it was a gun.
and immediately he felt easier because he knew he was going to kill with it. He was like Bruno. Hadn't he sensed it time and time again and like a coward never admitted it? Hadn't he known Bruno was like himself? Or why he liked Bruno? He loved Bruno. Bruno had prepared every inch of the way for him. And everything would go well because everything always went well for Bruno. The world was geared for people like Bruno. So, what's going on here?
He's confessing his love.
Confessing his love in some ways, but what is this? The world was geared for people like Bruno.
He's envious.
He's envious maybe of Bruno's wealth, but what is it about Bruno maybe that guy is attracted to?
He's willing to take risks.
Willing to take risks, right? Drive blindfolded at 150 miles an hour.
Has everything under control.
Has everything under control.
Sometimes.
Right? And he's also this idea of murder as another thing to cross off his list. It's kind of transcendence of morality, of good and evil. And it's something where we can call a guy weak, and maybe part of his weakness is what makes him so attracted to Bruno. And this kind of almost Superman, kind of above good and evil, Brenna.
I feel like I was like pretty like prim and proper, almost like Anne's friend even says like he's so serious. I said you were crazy, or Anne was crazy when she said she wanted to marry you. And so he's lived his life that way, but then he sees Bruno, who drinks however much he wants and does whatever he wants, breaks into people's houses just to cross off his list and wants to murder people, but he's well off and doing
yeah.
what he wants, and he's still successful and happy, kind of.
And that's kind of, you know, Guy is trying to get into that world, right? Both with Anne, but also with Bruno. And Bruno offers another way in to that world of the jet set, of the rich, of the wealthy. And there's always that tension there. And I'm just really interested because Guy is a weak character, but he's also a fascinating character. And I think where Guy starts to, I think, get really complex and interesting is this next passage we'll look at. First of all, I was blown away that Guy actually kills him. He goes in there and he takes those two shots, and there's kind of like this green vision of him trying to get through Great Neck back home. That's a really compelling, like 15 to 20 pages. And just this idea, again, of the kind of banality of murder. They do it, and then they start forgetting it and going on with their lives. Although, unlike Crimes and Misdemeanors, which we talked about by Woody Allen, this idea that that guilt goes away, at least Highsmith has the guilt always eating at Guy. He never gets it up, and I think he never gets it up. He never gets over it. And I think, who says that? I'm forgetting his name. Gerard knows that. What's going to get him? It's because he's so guilty. Right? So, let's go to this point. And I think 165, an interesting point, this is kind of a family point. My family owned a bar in New York City called Clark's in the 40s and 50s. And I'm wondering if that's the bar that he was in. It'd be interesting. My father's mother's family were Clark, and her father owned a bar in New York City called Clark's. So I'm wondering, I'm gonna have to look personal history and see. It's on page 165. So I have it like, oh, interesting. Maybe there's something there. Maybe I can go get a free drink. Anyway, after this book, you really want a drink.
Yeah.
Right? You really do, because everyone's drinking all the time. It's really bizarre. One time, 178, 179, then we're going to get to this theory again. 178, 179 is like the first time we hear about God in the five or six books we've read. God kind of comes up again. And we hear, oddly enough, and it's kind of a throwaway line at the bottom of 78 into 79. At 17, he had discovered God by himself. This is talking about Guy. He had discovered God through his own awakening talents and through a sense of unity of all the arts and then of nature, finally of science, of all the creating and ordering forces in the world. He believed he could not have done his work without a belief in God. And where had his belief been when he murdered? He had forsaken God. Not God him. It seemed to him that no human being had ever been born or had needed to bear so much guilt as he. And it's almost like this weird moment like you have in Crime and Punishment, where God is just an afterthought. Right? There's no real compelling sense that God is anywhere in this narrative or in this world. Almost as if it's thrown in. Now, here's another interesting point, and this is brought up by, I think,
his mother when he's talking about this, right? 180, 180. He thought of his mother. Who wants to read that part? He thought of his mother. Thank you, Jason. Loud.
He thought of his mother and felt he could never let her embrace him again. He remembered her telling him that all men were equally good, because all men had souls and the soul was entirely good. Evil, she said, always came from externals. And so he had believed even months after Miriam, when he wanted to murder her lover, Steve. So he believed on the train, reading his Plato, and himself, the second horse of the charioteer that had always been obedient as the first. But love and hate, he thought now, good and evil, live side by side in the human heart, and not merely in differing proportions in one man and the next, but all good and all evil. One had merely to look for a little of either to find it all. One had merely to scratch the surface. All things had opposites close by, every direction and reason against it, every animal and animal that destroys it, the male, the female, and the positive, the negative. The splitting of the atom was the only true destruction, the breaking of the universal law of oneness. Nothing could be without its opposite that was bound up with it. Could space exist in a building without objects that stopped it? Could energy exist without matter, or matter without energy? Matter and energy, the inert and the active, once considered opposites, were now known to be one.
Good. That's a pretty intense passage. One of the most intense, I think, is in the book. How would you read this? Make of this? There's a couple of things to kind of unpack, as they say. Anything strike anyone?
It's very existential.
Very existential in that, like, we're starting to deal with these questions of good and evil. And how does Guy define good and evil here?
One has
everyone
to
be
all good and all evil.
What?
That everyone is all good and all evil.
Right? We're both. There is no, like, Guy's evil. He's the evil one. He's the bad guy in this book. No, Bruno, or Guy, I'm sorry, Bruno is the evil one in this book. In fact, Guy and Bruno are made of the same matter. They're both just as good or just as evil. And as his mother says, right, it starts it, evil, she said, always came from the externals. We're all born with a soul. We're all good. Evil was always premised, right, and this is kind of a theory, upon our environment. I was evil because I didn't have food and I had to kill to survive, right? Based on my conditions of survival, right? It wasn't like I was the fifth child, if you've ever read the book, just naturally evil, like some sort of Harley Davidson motorcycle ride. I'm kidding, because I heard that. It's a sound effect, trying to bring it in to the classroom. But this idea that evil itself was always an external, but God, I mean, goes outside of that. And he says this, but love and hate, he thought now, good and evil live side by side in the human heart, and not merely in differing proportions in one man and the next, but all good and all evil. One had merely to look for a little of either to find all. One had merely to scratch the surface. All things had opposites close by, every decision or reason against it, every animal an animal that destroys it. Do we think of sharks as evil when they eat fish?
No.
Right? We don't think of a jaguar as evil when it eats an elk, right? If they eat elk or whatever, they eat gazelles, right? Right? I mean, it's part of the process, right? Like, our idea of morality breaks down when we start thinking of the kind of frame of nature. And it's interesting how Guy here is this kind of oneness vision of the universe, how we're all everything. And he brings that down into a very interesting figure that I think, for me, sets the stage of the post-war moment in this book probably better than all the drinking and all the Nietzschean morality, anything. What is the only thing that can destroy this? The one thing that can destroy that oneness, that unison, that kind of, I would say, yin-yang vision of good and evil. What's the one thing that can destroy it all?
Splitting of an atom. The
splitting of an atom. It's an image. Why would that image resonate for the reader in 1950?
Did they just discover
atoms? Atom bomb, right? The atom bomb, first time, 1945, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. This moment is known as the atomic age. This is when we start entering the Cold War. This is when they have duck and cover videos, right? How are you going to survive the post-apocalyptic nuclear war? You're going to duck and get under the nearest desk. We know that's absurd, but this is that moment.
Highsmith, in many ways, with that moment, the only thing that can destroy humanity, and this very complicated, almost intermingled notion of good and evil, is the destruction of an entire world. And we can actually think that to scale at that moment in history, because we've had nuclear war. The atomic bomb was used, and it was used by Americans in 1945. That's a very interesting fact.
Twice.
Mm-hmm. Right? And so here we have that moment of the atomic age and what defines the atomic age. The suburbs, right? The bomb shelters, right? The dinners, two kids, one boy, one girl. The father goes to work, the mother stays at home. That's the vision of the atomic age. Or at least that's the kind of commercialized, sold, commodified vision. And then you have this horrific vision that Highsmith, I think, puts forth. And it's a vision, at the heart of it, is this question of morality. Which, going back to Dostoevsky, but even well before there, is kind of a question of the age. How do we maintain a sense of morality without God? Without a sense of morality? It's a horrific idea, right? It's almost like the thing that only can clear the slate is this atomic splitting of the atom. I love this image, in that, for me, kind of sets the moment of this book better than anything. That figure wouldn't have worked in Ask the Dust. It would have been impossible in our time. That figure is in many ways married to Highsmith's moment and married to a cultural understanding. Many of you did this very well in the midterm when you wrote about how does a book in many ways define the cultural moment within which it was written. And there's no more perfect example than Highsmith using the figure of the atom to talk about the end of good and evil, to talk about the end of humanity. It's a really kind of powerful moment, and it's rooted in the 1950s, so deeply. I mean, it's a great figure. Okay, now, let us go, and there's a lot to talk about, obviously. And that was on, what page was that on again? That was on 180. Okay, so let's jump a bit. Okay, remember we talked about that women point in the 50s? To go back to that, let's go to 187. Let's look at the 187. It's the first full paragraph from the top. It's actually moved over from the next page. And was different. See that? About six lines down, seven lines down. Anyone want to read that, Anne? Jillian.
Anne was different, of course, or she wouldn't have been attracted to him in the first place. She was not one of the beautiful young girls who worked at a career for a couple of years just to say they'd done it before they married one of the eligible young men. But wouldn't she have been just the same herself without him? She had often told him he was her inspiration, he and his own ambition. But she had had the same talent, the same drive the day he met her, and wouldn't she have gone on? And wouldn't another man, like himself, but worthy of her, have found her? He began to walk toward her.
Yeah. I mean, we talked about this earlier in the day, but in fact, kind of turning the figure. He's her muse, right? Rather than the muse being the figure for the great artistic man, that guy, in many ways, is the muse of Anne in her work. And she's one of those figures of the post-50s era that I think, you know, marks a different kind of woman. Now, we could talk about in that Betty Friedan article, I mean, that book, The Feminine Mystique, is a really important book to think about in this context, because it frames a whole kind of, you know, the next 40 or 50 years of thinking about what happened in this period. And many feminists think in the 1950s was a huge step back from the 40s. A huge step back. And when we talk about feminism, people get all like, what does that mean? It's a very radical concept. Equal rights for women. Oh, wait. Who could possibly be against that? Right?
Jesse.
It's a problem. It's a deep, deep problem. It is. Even as a joke.
No.
Okay.
Yes.
There's a big point, right, in 30. And this is, I don't know, this is on chapter 30. This is in chapter 30, 186. I get really confused here. Maybe one of you can help me. Second full paragraph after 30, guy went out. You see that? Who wants to read that paragraph? Jesse.
Guy went out. The afternoon was still bright with sun, though the picket fence cast long oblique bars of shadow over the crocus and iris beds. He could just see Anne's tied back hair and pale green persuaded beyond the crest on the rolling sea of lawn. Many times he had gathered mint and watercress there at the end, from the stream that flowed out of the woods where he had fought Bruno. Bruno has passed, he reminded himself, gone, vanished. Whatever method Gerard used, he had made Bruno afraid to contact him.
This is what I don't understand. Can anyone track in this book where Guy would know about Gerard at this point in the novel?
Well, I don't know if he knew his name, but he knew that Bruno's father had lived
it. He did. Brenna?
Well, I was going to say maybe the author was having like a stupid moment because Annie, it says Annie here too. It's the only time in the book that
where it says
Annie, not Anne.
I mean, and I gotta go back and double check this, but I was wondering, and you may be right, you may know Gerard. I just didn't know if he knew Gerard, he knew him by name. And I'm pretty sure this is Dally speaking.
I think you mentioned it in one of the letters that he sent out.
Maybe that came up. So for me, I don't know, it was just a question. I want to see if anyone was like, yeah, I know, or noticed as much. But I just didn't know that Guy was aware of Gerard at that point. Gerard comes in pretty much after page 200. He becomes that kind of detective character that we're used to. Okay. We're going to end with the scene on the boat. Well, there's a couple of points, but let's just go to 226. Right? And we'll go 226, and then we'll go to that final scene on the boat. 226, there's that huge paragraph to start the page with. Let's start reading at Buddy Didn't Mind, because he felt so wise now somehow. Anyone want to read that? Buddy Didn't Mind. Yes, Sarah.
But he didn't mind because he felt so wise now somehow and really so content. Only yesterday he had wanted to go around the world. And why? To say he had been? To say to whom? Last month he had written to William B., volunteering to go down in the new super bathysphere that they were testing first without a man inside. Why? Everything was silly compared to the night when magic happened. Every person he knew was silly compared to God. Silliest of all to think he'd wanted to see a lot of European women. Maybe the captain's whores had soured him, so what? Lots of people thought sex was overrated. No love lasts forever, the psychologist said. But he really shouldn't say that about Guy and Anne. He had a feeling theirs might last, but just why, he didn't know. It wasn't only that Guy was so wrapped up in her he was blind to all the rest. It wasn't just that Guy had enough money now. It was something invisible that he hadn't even thought of yet. Sometimes he felt he was right on the brink of thinking of it. No, he didn't want the answer for himself. Purely in the spirit of scientific inquiry.
Okay. There's this point there when he talks about silliest of all to think he wanted to see a lot of European women. Every person he knew was silly compared to Guy. Silliest of all to think he wanted to see a lot of European women. And then he says everything was silly compared to that night in Metcalf. Right? And I have this highlighted not only with the point of Dostoevsky, but also with the point of Superman. What's going on here? What is Bruno suggesting?
He can
do anything, right? There's that kind of vision of him as Superman. Everything was silly. Going down in an untested bathysphere, you know what a bathysphere is? Kind of like an early submarine. You go down there and like, possibly, unless you're James Cameron, you'll get crushed by pressure, right? You go, you know, hundreds of thousands of feet below the sea. So that's kind of a very risky thing to do, especially if it's untested. But he's really thinking of himself as a Superman. And I think one of the things he's trying to get towards in the question, or Patricia Smith, Highsmith is trying to get towards in this, really comes out at the end. And let's go to 261. Because I think Highsmith, one of the things, not only is she talking about the question of class, labor relations, and the notion of guys wanting to break into that world, but again and again it comes up, kind of like in Miller's Crossing with ethics and morality. We see it again in Red Harvest, where we have no sense of a moral compass, right? This Berg is driving me crazy. Okay, and someone did that really well, talking about that on the midterm in terms of this vision of morality. Well, this book actually kind of in some ways spells out that whole question of morality that you framed nicely, Leo, and it kind of, for me, has informed the book. Let's go to 261. Starting at the point, yes, Guy said he was conscious of Anne Small. And this is when they're on the boat. This gets really weird. Another dreamlike vision. Very surreal. Yes, Guy said. He was conscious of Anne's small, tense smile. And this is, go and tell him I'm your closest friend, Guy. Right? That's what Bruno's saying to Guy. Yes, Guy said. He was conscious of Anne's small, tense smile, because there's all sorts of tension between him and Anne right now around Bruno. Didn't she know everything now? Wasn't she merely waiting for him and Bruno to put it into words in the next seconds? And I'm wondering if they're talking about the murder or something else. And suddenly it was like the moment in the coffee shop, the afternoon of the Friday night, when he felt he had already told Anne everything that he was going to do. He was going to tell her, he remembered, but the fact he hadn't quite yet told her that Bruno was once more dancing around him seemed the last good measure of excoriation for his delay. Sure, I'm mad, Bruno shouted to Helen, who was inching away from him on the seat. Mad enough to take on the whole world and whip it. Any man doesn't think I whipped it, I'll settle him privately. He laughed. And the laugh he saw only bewildered and blurred stupid faces around him, tricked them into laughing with him. Monkeys! He threw at them cheerfully. I really love Bruno at that point, when he's calling everybody monkeys. Like, I can see myself drunk doing that. Monkeys! Right? Who is he? Bob whispered to Guy. Guy and I are supermen, Bruno said. You're a Superman drinker, Helen remarked. That's not true, Bruno struggled up to one knee. Charles came down and told him. What happens to Bruno right after this? Falls off the boat. Drowns. And who jumps in to save him?
Guy.
In this kind of weird moment, right? Where it's like he's... Everyone leaves the room. Let's look at that quickly. This is such a weird moment. Guy drives in to save him, right? Doesn't. And at the end, 263, I'll read it here. He went down again, deep as he could, spreading his ridiculous length as wide as he could, but now there seemed nothing but a silent gray vacuum filling all space, in which he was only a tiny point of consciousness. The swift, unbearable loneliness pressed him closer, threatening to swallow his own life. He stretched his eyes desperately. The grayness became a brown, rich floor. I mean, beautiful description of that kind of existential kind of moment, right? The vacuum filling all space, which loneliness was a tiny point of consciousness. The swift, unbearable loneliness pressed him closer. I mean, this is him in the water, obviously, looking for God, but it's also this kind of existential, surreal description. Just brilliant. Did you find him? He blurted, raising up himself. What time is it? Lie still, Guy, Bob's voice said. He went down, Guy, and said, we saw him. Guy closed his eyes and wept. He was aware that, one by one, they all went out of the bunk room and left him. Even Anne. For my money, that would have been a brilliant ending. Right there. The kind of Owen ending for me, I mean, we know Guy's going to get caught. We know Gerard. They just spell it out. But for me, this is where the book ends. Everything else is just basically explaining out what he knows. This is kind of the end, not only to their relationship, but this question of their being supermen, and the kind of larger question of, you know, is Guy just a weakling? Or was there a relationship and a deep kind of bond that was premised on these Nietzschean questions of Superman? Which actually not only makes the movie interesting and maybe not as complicated in some ways philosophically, but far more compelling in terms of the ways it deals with this question of doubles, which get brought up, but also makes a film like Rope by Hitchcock very interesting, because Rope very explicitly frames this relationship of these two gay lovers from the 20s who go on this kind of ubermensch vision and trip to kill someone. And I'm now wondering whether Highsmith's novel might, in fact, and it's Leopold, and I'm forgetting the other name of the character, but they're actually, you know, it's a historical couple.
Yeah, I learned about that.
You did?
Yeah, he had like horn glasses.
Absolutely. And they were very wealthy.
Yeah.
And they were very intelligent.
Sick guy.
And sick, two sick guys. Well, some people might argue they weren't sick, if you go by Guy's theory of morality. Right? We're all sick. We're all potentially murderers. And I think Strange on the Train is trying to argue that, right? We all have that evil in us.
Now, whether we believe it or not is another question, but, I mean, that's the kind of moral figure this book is throwing at you. And to end it on this vision of Superman and him crying at the death of Bruno, it's kind of a, it's a moment, you know, and kind of moves us, I think, as we move out of the 40s in Mildred Pierce into the 50s, I think it moves us deeper and deeper into this kind of larger moral quandary. Now, a couple of things. Next week, we're going to read Cotton Comes to Harlem, right?
Get that on your schedule. We're going to spend part of Tuesday also talking about the Wikipedia project. I'm going to send out an email with the details. How do you all feel about movie night on... How about, can any of you do movie day? Well, I'm not going to even try and schedule something. I'm thinking about doing Strangers on the Train on Monday night from 7 to 9. Pizza, soda, whatever. So if you can make it, great. And then we'll set up another movie for Cotton Comes to Harlem. We'll have another movie night for that, okay? So Monday at 7, I'm thinking, for Strangers on a Train. Make sense? Yeah. Have a great night.